My name is Jean Balance. I'm coming to you from the EPA's Technology Innovation and Field Services Division based in Washington, D.C., where I'm here to help moderate our seminar. Today's seminar will cover practical models to support remediation strategy decision-making, and this is part three of a five-part seminar series, which has been sponsored by the EPA's Office of Superfund Remediation and Technology Innovation, and we'll have speakers joining us from Clemson University, GSI Environmental, as well as the Savannah River National Laboratory. I'm going to go ahead and cover a couple of housekeeping items for everybody, giving others just a minute or two more to join us, and then we'll start the live technical broadcast. As I mentioned earlier, today's broadcast is going to happen with a new tool that we're testing out on Kluin called Adobe Connect. Adobe Connect will allow us to actually deliver the event to you live in real time, so our individual presenters will be able to move through the materials, point to things, and actually share files, websites, and show you live demonstrations of computer software in real time from each of their geographic locations. So all of the content will be displayed to our participants through the Adobe Connect meeting room. If you're interested, Adobe Connect actually works on PCs, Macs, as well as mobile devices. There are apps you can download from the Apple iTunes Store as well as the Google Play Store. If you are solely participating with print copies of the materials and via telephone lines, please note that only a portion of the broadcast is available that way. There will be some of the live delivery that you'll miss out on, and I would encourage you to refer back to the recording when it's available to see some of the live demonstrations that you may miss from just the print copies of the materials. By default, audio in Adobe Connect is streamed online, which means everybody should be listening to me through your computer speakers. If you're having problems with that online audio stream, the first thing you'll want to do is take a look in the upper left corner of the Adobe Connect room and look for a green speaker icon. As long as it's shaded green, the online broadcast has begun for you. If you're having problems with volumes too low, check your local volume settings. Make sure your speakers are turned up. You may find that using headphones actually helps a lot. If you're having skips in the online audio, it might be related to your internet connection, especially if you're in a public Wi-Fi. That may be causing some of the problems, and I'd encourage you to try to find a local LAN connection or a more solid internet connection if you can. If you continue to experience audio problems, please use the Q&A pod to report those issues. And if we have extra phone lines, I'll be happy to distribute to them to you so you can dial in and listen to us through the phone. All of those of you on the phone have been globally muted, as I mentioned earlier. We would ask you remain muted until we get to the breaks for Q&A with our presenters. And at that time, you can hit #6 to unmute your line and ask a question. I would, though, encourage you to remain muted until we get to those breaks for Q&A with our presenters. As I mentioned earlier, Q&A is going to happen. We prefer to have the questions come in electronically using the Q&A pod. Some of you have already started using that, so I'll draw your attention to the window or pod in the lower right corner of your screen. It says Q&A on the top, and there's actually a white blank field where you can type your comments or questions below. Feel free to test that out if you're not sure. If it's working, go ahead and type something up, and I'll be happy to let you know. It's a private Q&A pod, so anything you type in there is visible only by myself and the other presenters, and then I can actually type a private response back to you as well. We'll go ahead and queue those questions up, and when we take those breaks, I'll read them out loud to the presenters so they can answer them. But feel free to also use that window to report technical difficulties or, again, request a telephone line if you need one. I would also encourage you to use that because if we can't answer anything live, we can save those questions and actually use them to contact you later on to try to address the questions offline. Today's entire session will be recorded. We unfortunately took a little bit longer to get last week's seminar, part two of the series, up and available, but it was posted yesterday on Kluin. Hopefully it's only going to take us 2 or 3 days to get this recording up. I'm hoping sooner than that. But you will automatically receive an email as soon as that recording is available. And if you want to browse the other two seminars in the series, parts one and parts two, you'll find them on the Kluin archive page, which is, again, active and shown at the bottom of slide two. Just a few visual reminders on slide three. This is just a screenshot. Again, the content will be displayed in a live portion of your sharing window. If you need to modify your seminar audio, there's a little green icon that looks like a computer speaker. You can actually click it to turn it on and off or click the downward pointing triangle next to it and actually modify your own seminar audio. You'll see other items that may change, including who's sponsoring the event, links to download files, the Q&A window that I'm asking you to use to report your questions or comments and technical problems. You can simply type your answers here and hit the enter button. And then the other thing I want to be sure to draw everybody's attention to, there may be a portion of the broadcast today, in particular the live demonstration of REM-CLOR or REM-SHUL, that may be hard to view in this format. So I want to draw your attention to a full screen button. If you're looking at the share window, in the upper right corner, you'll see a button that says full screen. It's a toggle switch. It looks just like this. You can actually click that full screen button. It'll blow the slides up and make them much larger. If you want to turn it off and go back to the normal view, simply click the full screen button again, and it'll bring you back into the normal environment so you can type in questions or see other windows. If that's still not good enough, once you go to the full screen mode, there'll be another icon that'll appear near the full screen button that'll actually, it looks like a sort of a computer box or a window with scroll bars on it. That's the zoom function. If you click that, it'll zoom in even further and allow you to scroll around and recenter the content manually. I think that's about the end of all the reminders and welcoming statements that I can provide to everybody. So I'm going to go ahead and encourage our presenters to take over and begin the formal presentation. And we'll start with Brian Looney.
Thank you, Jean. Can you see my screen?
We can, and looks like you're going to pull the slide deck up, and you are all set to start.
Great. Thanks, Jean. I'd like to start off by recognizing and thanking the organizations and individuals who have sponsored the development of the content and the delivery of this workshop, and in particular, the U.S. Environmental Protection Agency, and that would be EPA's Circle Education Center, the EPA ORD Superfund and Technology Liaison Program, and EPA Office of Underground Storage Tanks, and specifically to individuals, Kira Lynch and Queenie Mungin-Davis, who have supported this workshop in particular. I'd also like to thank the U.S. Department of Defense, the Strategic Environmental Research and Development, and the Environmental Security Technology Certification Programs, CERTIP and ESTCP, and the U.S. Department of Energy Office of Soil and Groundwater Cleanup. Now, what I'd like to do is start off by saying that it's our goal in this workshop to encourage creative, thoughtful, technically based environmental decision making, to encourage critical and strategic thinking related to source and plume cleanup, matching technologies to problems. I think it's important to note it's not our intent to present information that replaces or conflicts in any way with regulatory policies, guidance, and requirements, you know, like the NCP for hydrocarbons or CERCLA and RCRA for other hazardous contaminants. And as a reminder, this is the third of a five-part workshop, but I wanted to remind folks that our workshop team firmly believes that there are a range of tools that support creative and strategic thinking, and these range from simple hand calculations to screening tools to simplified analytical models up to flexible and somewhat more complex and sometimes very complex numerical models. In the course of delivering the five modules, we provide examples of hand calculations and screening tools, but basically, our main focus is on practical tools because these represent a level of modeling that has been widely used throughout our colleagues and industries and has proven useful for many sites. These are kind of a nice compromise of simplicity and power, and we're going to specifically focus on two recent tools that were developed with the support of EPA and DOD, REM-CLOR and REM-FUEL. These models have the unique formulation that encourages asking what-if questions and exploring potential combinations of source and plume cleanup for a variety of contaminants. These models used in combination with other tools, things that help screen sites, things that talk about the performance of specific classes of technology, soil vapor extraction, pump and treat, etc., have proven incredibly useful, and we think they're kind of a sweet spot in modeling. For many sites, this level of modeling can support a decision, so the kind of simple analytical models, things like that. But for others, you can use this level of modeling to pre-screen options and then support the application of follow-on numerical solutions such as ModFlow, RT3D, the TUF family of codes, et cetera. And as most of you are aware that are at this point, you've like stuck with us for two of the three and you're on the third one, so you're certainly aware that there are a number of tools on the market that make those numerical models easier to use by assisting with mesh generation and graphical outputs. Things like GMS, Visual Mod Flow, Groundwater Vistas, and many others. And for those of you who I haven't mentioned your brand, I apologize. But, you know, a main point is that, you know, we're not about brands of models. What we're about is using these tools to really help in thinking and decision making. What I'd like to do is give a quick introduction to our workshop team. We have Ron Falta from Clemson University. He's a leading model developer and practitioner. He's developed some of the most useful numerical modeling tools that are available to us, things like T2VOC, and was the principal developer of RemClor and RemFuel in collaboration with EPA scientists at the Ada Laboratory. We also have Chuck Newell from GSI, who is a principal resource to both EPA and the Department of Defense in taking kind of existing information about environmental cleanup and organizing it in useful and helpful summarized ways. And then other principals in the workshop, they include Karen Vangelis, who was here at Savannah River National Laboratory, who was the project manager when we first began developing the materials for this workshop. Myself, I was the technical coordinator developing the workshop, and Shala Farhat from GSI in Houston, who works with Ron, and she has developed a wide range of some of the supporting practical tools that are out there, and we'll mention those as we go along in the set of workshops. We're located at a number of locations around the country, so it's been interesting, exciting to use the Adobe Connect tool. We understand from Gene that things have gone pretty smoothly. In fact, Gene told us folks are participating in their offices, in conference rooms, in coffee shops. Several folks have reported in that they're participating from their cars. So I
think
Ron...
We're concerned. We don't want anybody running the models while they're driving their car.
Yeah, I guess alternatively, we could port the software over to, like, the Ford Sync system so it can be installed in cars when people purchase them. I'm not sure about
passengers,
that.
It's okay.
Yeah. So we went through the last week's material pretty fast. We appreciate you hanging in on that kind of important step of setting up the background. And we're gonna try to go through things a bit more relaxed for the final three modules. And I thought what I would do is just give you just a brief preview of what you can expect for this week and the next two. This week we'll spend quite a bit of time looking at RemFuel and running that particular program. Next week we're going to run through RemClor several times for some challenging remediation scenarios. And for the final, the fifth module, we are now currently working because it's interesting to try to do an interactive course through this web format. But we're trying to develop some materials that include tips and tricks for running the models and to allow more real-time interactions from the participants. As I said, we went through things pretty quickly last week. So if you had problems or issues or uncertainties, we think that the several more times that we're going to run through the programs will really help answer those questions that you might have and get over any activation energy you have for firing up the model and running the program. So with that, I think what we want to do is set some time aside for questions from last week's material, and I think Gene is going to facilitate that process.
Okay. Well, we, again, invite those of you who are joining us today. If you have questions from last week, please feel free to type them up in the Q&A window. I do have two that were emailed to me, and I can go ahead and start with those. So if you have a question from last week, now is the time to quickly type it up in the Q&A window. And I'm going to go ahead and start with the first two that I received via email. And this first question comes from a participant who asked, aside from what's in the user manual, are there any additional literature articles detailing the stream tube approach being used for dispersion? And has it been benchmarked or compared against other codes?
This is Ron. There's a groundwater paper from 2008 that it has mostly the same material that's in the user's manual, but it also has an additional comparison with an analytical solution. That stream tube model matches the analytical dispersion solution. If you have scale-dependent dispersion, it matches it very well, provided you use enough stream tubes to make it smooth.
Okay, great. So part two comes in, and they ask, noting that this may have already been covered, but when a remedy is reduced by, say, 90%, how does REMCore REMFuel treat the source mass reduction? Does it A, reduce the concentration, leaving the source by 90%, or B, keep the source concentration at the original level, but reduce the amount of mass by 90%, and it there depletes more rapidly, or is it some sort of combination of both A and B?
This is Chuck. I'll grab that one, and Ron and Brian, you can dive in. But the relationship between mass removal and how the concentration changed, that's all based on this gamma function, or this dial you turn. And if you have a gamma equals 1, then a 90% reduction in mass will mean a 90% reduction in concentration. A gamma of less than 1, say it's 0.5, might be a 90% reduction in mass, but not that much reduction in concentration. And then for a gamma greater than 2, then it will be, let's see, I've got that backwards, right? Gamma less than 1, you're going to more or less be a step function. It's going to hang out, then go down later. But then gamma of 2, you're going to have this mass removal and have this long tail that comes out there.
Right,
Brian, Ron, you want to add to that?
Yeah, if the gamma is greater than 1, you get a larger reduction in concentration for a given fraction of the mass removed.
And, Ron, this is Brian. Just to kind of reiterate, there are several places that you can put different remedial actions into REMCore and REMFuel, and the kind of percent reduction knob is in the source reduction. And so what you do is you go in, you say, I have a technology A, B, or C, thermal remediation, Chemox, whatever, and I have independently looked at that, and it's going to remove 80% over this period of time, and you simply put that in. And then you're removing mass, and then REMCore then relates that to the concentration coming off the source by the gamma, and the remedial actions you take out in the plume are done as first-order decay coefficients. So you would go in and you would change the first-order decay coefficients, and that allows you to look at the effect of different remediations out in the plume. So there's a difference in how remediation is accounted for in the source, which is considered a relatively small and discrete zone, versus the plume, which is this larger diffuse area.
And let me just go back with that gamma, say, of equal 2. What happens is that immediately after that source is in place, you see this rapid drop in concentration for the first couple of years. And so, but then it levels out. It's almost a, are you going to pay me now or pay me later? So gamma of 2, quick concentration drop over the first, say, 10 or 20 years, and then it levels out, and then there's not much change after that.
Okay, great. We do have another question that came in asking if REMCore is available for free, and how does one access it? I send a response back to them directly, and I've also changed the meeting environment. So you'll find a new window in the upper right corner, related URLs. The answer is yes, the models are available for free. And the link to actually download the models is available at the bottom of that related URL pod or window, but you can find it on the EPA NIRML website.
And then, Gene, also, if you just go to Google and type REMCore or REMFuel, it'll take you straight to the Cosmos, which is where the downloading place is.
Yep, excellent. We do have a question that it came in, and they ask, if you are unsure of the mass of the source, can these models predict based on test results from monitoring wells?
Yeah, this is Brian. The short answer is no. You can certainly put in a range and kind of see what matches the best, but Chuck and Shala may want to comment. There are other tools out there that you take concentrations and other types of data, and then they attempt to back calculate some masses.
And so, yeah, you could use there's some of the different source decay is a model that has a utility in there where you can put in soil data, milligram per kilogram, say in the saturated zone or in the unsaturated zone, and get kilograms of mass that's in there. But just note, that's the number that's the mass today. And what you have to put into RemChlor or RemFuel is the mass, the original mass that started out. So that can guide you a bit, but in some ways it doesn't tell you the complete story. You need to put in that mass at day one or whenever that release originally happened.
And just another note, that Source Decay is also a free software.
Okay, let's continue with the online questions. We have another one asking about RemChlor and the model. And they ask if you had input parameters for the section of source remediation where you're looking at the fraction remove, if that equals 0.9, and the start time is 30 years and the end time is 31 years, does it mean that 1 year from the 30th to 31st year, the source mass will be removed by 90%?
That's right. Over that period between year 30 and 31, 90% of what is there at year 30 is taken out.
And you want to be a little careful. You can't put really long times in there, but that allows you to do source remediation over a few-year period of time. But it is just a linear function, right, Ron?
Yeah, it calculates how much mass, you know, would a 90% reduction mean, and then it just spaces it out evenly over that time period.
Right.
So it's intended, like Brian said, for a relatively short period, a half a year, a month or so.
A couple of years maybe.
Yeah.
Yeah. Okay,
great. We do have a clarifying statement regarding the question about the availability of RemChlor, and they actually were referring to PremChlor, which starts with PremChlor. The probabilistic model that was discussed in Liang's groundwater monitoring and remediation article that you mentioned at last seminar. Is that available for free, and if so, how does one access it?
That one is free. This is Ron. Probably the best way is to send me an email, and then I can get Hylian to send you the files. Hylian Lang worked on this for a PhD, or I can send you the files. But just send me an email, and I'll send you the files you need.
And Ron, does that run by itself, or do you need GoldSim?
You need a free GoldSim player, and we can send you instructions for how to get that.
Okay, good.
But everything is free, so that's a key thing.
Okay. We do have another question, and then we'll see if you want to keep going. The last question I'm going to take online, but remember, we're still queuing them up, so if you have a question in here that we didn't get to, don't worry. It's not gone. We'll try to address it later on. This next question, though, comes in from Gary, who asks, since there are several parameters that are tweaked to calibrate the model, do you have advice about how to tweak the values to get the, quote, optimal solution?
This is Chuck. In terms of the plume, I think a lot of the work is done with the decay coefficients as opposed to the dispersion or retardation. Typically, that's going to be at many sites a more important parameter than, say, sorption or the dispersion stuff. I typically don't mess around with the dispersion too much. I turn it down pretty low and really focus on the decay coefficients to get the right plume length and things like that. Regarding the source model, then there's some uncertainty sometimes when the source was released. And, of course, there's uncertainty in the groundwater velocity, and that's another dial that seems like on sites we've used to that. We've turned that dial. Brian, Ron?
The initial concentration has a pretty big influence on the results as well.
Yeah, so those are the things you do, and what you do is you look at the specifics for your site, and as Ron has shown and will show as we continue to move along, it's some of these things vary together. So, you know, you get the same effect from it's like the ratio of the flow velocity to the degradation coefficient. So you have to be a little cautious that, you know, sometimes there's not a unique solution. But then you look at site-specific issues. So Ron showed an example the other day where the plume spread out laterally. And that was likely the result of over time, varying flow directions as boundary conditions changed. And so what you do there is use a slightly higher transverse dispersion to generate a plume that more accurately matches the environment, even though, you know, at any moment in time, you know, you don't have that much transverse dispersion, but overall you get something like that. So those are the kinds of logic that you put into that.
Okay. Well, I think in the interest of time, we're going to go ahead with the presentation. We'll continue to queue those questions up, though, and I'll go ahead and turn things back to you guys for the presentation.
Thanks, Jean. So last time we spent a lot of time looking at what happens if we do source remediation by itself, and that was really a question that sets up, you know, when do you need to do source, when do you need to do plume, when do you need to do a combination. So what I'd like to do is just quickly summarize the kind of take-home messages from last week's runs of RemChlor, RemFuel that had to do with source remediation. And some of the take-home messages are that source remediation is based on the literature, based on these multi-site studies, can often remove 90 to 99.9% of a contaminant from the target volume. So 1 to 3 orders of magnitude, or ohms, as Chuck described. Source remediation can be expensive. It reduces the contaminant discharge that feeds the plume. That's a key benefit of it. But particularly for plumes where they've developed over 1 or 2 decades or even longer, what we showed with the model output is it takes time for the plume to respond. So you get the idea of these plumes where the source disconnects from the plume over, you know, 5, 10, 15, 20-year time frame. Other take-home messages from last week's run: source remediation shortens the life of the source. That's another key benefit of the idea. I should point out that, you know, we believe that consistent with all the regulatory guidance, that if there is accessible significant sources left in the environment, that taking actions to remove the source to the extent practicable makes sense, and we think the modeling in general supports that. But it's also important to note that source remediation rarely achieves drinking water standards in the source zone immediately after deployment for many of these contaminants, and that's because they're sometimes 3, 4, and 5 orders of magnitude above their standards. So if you remove 2 orders of magnitude of the source material, you still have groundwater concentrations above standards, at least in the short to medium term. The most important thing is that the likely response of the plume to source remediation can be modeled using a variety of tools like RemChlor and RemFuel and many of the other tools that we have talked about. So that's just kind of the cliff notes of what we learned from the runs last week. What did I miss, Chuck and Ron?
I think that covers it. That's pretty good.
Mm-hmm. Okay, cool. What I'd like to do then to kind of emphasize those points is show this diagram again. This is the one that that Ron originally developed for our team, and then we've worked with it quite a bit. We could certainly add more columns to this, but these are three that seem to be pretty helpful. What we tried to do was develop this approach of the slot machine, where these different columns are working independently. And so what you can have is, where is the bulk of the contaminant mass? Is it in the source zone? Is it mostly in the plume? Is it a combination? If you have data on the plume dynamics, is it growing, stable, or shrinking? And then how much concentration reduction is needed from kind of your maximum levels to the amount that you desire? And we organize these in a specific way, and recognizing, once again, this is kind of a slot machine, so these can spin independently. You can get something that's in the top of one column and in the bottom of another column, and so these are organized in a way to help develop what is the value of source remediation versus plume remediation or some combination needed. In general, the way these are organized is that if you're in the top of these columns, source remediation becomes relatively effective. So, for example, if most of your contaminant is in the source zone and the plume is growing, that means that it's in its early stages, and you only need a factor of 10 reduction. That means that if you do a fairly aggressive source reduction, you may, in fact, take care of most of the problem. Conversely, plume remediation becomes more effective and or more required as you move down the chart. So, for example, if most of your contaminant is in a dissolved plume, if it's stable or shrinking but it's large, if you have a factor of 10,000 required from the amount of reduction that you need, then it becomes more valuable and more requirable to do plume remediation. Then, of course, if you have some combination of factors where you have a lot of material in the source zone, but the plume is stable and you need a factor 10,000 reduction, just as an example, that's a case where strategically it would be wise to emphasize fairly aggressive source remediation, and there will be some need and some significant need to do plume remediation. So once again, the purpose of this workshop is to look at technical output from models and to help make strategic decisions about what's going to be the most significant kinds of things to do for interim and long-term actions that are going to give you the most effect that's best matched to the needs of your site. And Ron, you kind of developed this, so do you have thoughts on that?
Well, you know, this is not a precise kind of exercise. It's sort of a general way of looking at these sites, of kind of categorizing them. But again, I think the right-hand column is one of the most critical ones. How many orders of magnitude do you have to achieve in the cleanup? And the more orders of magnitude that you need to get, the more likely it is you're going to have to add plume remediation to source remediation.
Right, and that's something that recurs, Ron, over the literature over the last several years. We wrote some reports and papers about 5 years ago that emphasized this numbers of orders of magnitude and you know, how large plumes get and the time frame over that. And once again, it all relates back to the relationship between degradation and flow, and in essence, the driving force for expanding the plume and the damping forces of attenuation that are trying to keep the plume from expanding. And then the numbers of orders of magnitude that you need reduction all kind of drive the size the plume gets. So I think we're going to switch over, and Chuck's going to take us through some specific examples.
Great. Okay. Well, for all of you hydrocarbon folks out there working at UST sites or fuel sites, you've been very patient. We've had a lot of talk about TCE and chlorinateds and DNAPLs, and now we're going to – it's your time. Now we're going to talk about REM fuel. So this is a relatively new model for the underground storage tank sites or any hydrocarbon release sites. It came out in 2012. It's free. You can download it from the EPA website. Just do a Google search on REM fuel, and you can find it on their Cosmos webpage. Based on the REMCOR model, and this is all speculation on my part, but this sort of vision that Ron had finished REMCOR and then went to sleep one night and had this dream where he had these dancing TCE molecules, and they suddenly sort of transformed into benzene molecules, and he woke up in a start and says, darn it, I got to do REM fuel. So then he went into the office next morning at the Clemson and started programming this thing, taking the elements of REMCOR and then transitioning them to the fuels world. So different mix of characters, we're mixing with different types of organics here. We're talking about BTEX, we're talking about the oxygenates, we're talking about the other additives, MTBE, EDB, dichloroethane, but still some of the same functionality. You can go in and with your source term is take out a certain percentage of that mass, or you can go in and manipulate the plume and changing decay coefficients in there, or do both. So that's what we've got with REM fuel. Now, we've got the same basic setup, is that there's a source term and a plume term, and they're connected with all the different stream tubes, and that's how this mass comes from the source out to the dissolved plume. The source conceptual model is the same. Most of this mass is removed primarily by flushing. The biodegradation's in the aqueous phase. We've got some of our key equations down there in the below. But the way I visualize it, if you're really thinking about the source term, there's about seven numbers you have to put in there to represent this thing. You're going to assume this thing as a box. You're going to put in a time when the contaminant was originally released. You're going to put in the mass in kilograms. You're going to put the flow through this box, how much groundwater is actually flowing through there, entering and exiting. Some dimensions, say a width and a depth of the box. The original concentration, Ron mentioned that being a sensitive parameter in this modeling. And then finally, you're going to put in this gamma term. And this gamma term is the thing that relates this concentration to the mass. And it really can tell you that it's either the same relationship where concentration and mass are lockstep with a gamma of 1, or it tells you when the concentration term flattens out. And if it's less than 1, it flattens out early, and then the concentration drops very quickly near the end of the life of the source. With a gamma of 2, it's opposite. It drops quickly originally, and then you have the long tail. And we had some great email traffic since our last module. I think Ron said that for REM fuel, that a gamma of 1 is a is one idea that you would use to simulate some of this plume, the plume dynamics or the source dynamics. Since then, we've had some email traffic and talked about different cases, and I think we had and Ron and Brian pitch in here. But in terms of weathering, let's just say you have a source that's got an elnapple in it, it's slowly being dissolved away or flushed away, that would be a case where a gamma of 1 would be accurate because that mole fraction's going down, the concentration's going down, and so that's all related. And so just a plain weathering or dissolution of an elnapple source, you'd use a gamma of 1. Now, if you're doing some sort of remediation, active remediation, let's say it's what I call a phase change, type reaction, then you'd be thinking more something like sparging or biosparging, some technology that's focusing on the soluble components that are creating your plume, something that targets the benzene, for example, then you probably also use a gamma of 1 because you're just removing that mass, the mole fraction goes down, and so that would represent this life cycle and this big jump when you remove that mass during remediation. However, other technologies, maybe called mass removal, if you want to refer it to that way, say just LNAPL recovery or free product recovery, that might have a different gamma, maybe a lower gamma, because you can remove some of that LNAPL mass, and the concentrations don't change that much originally. Ron, Brian, any thoughts on that?
I guess this is Ron. What we feel like is if you have a spill site where there's lots of free product in wells, and where you're recovering the free product, you may recover quite a large mass then, but it may not immediately affect the concentrations. So it may be better in that case to use a smaller gamma value. But I feel like once you get down to residual saturations, to the trap fraction, once you start removing that mass, it's more likely to respond like with a gamma of 1.
Hey, Ron, this is Brian. I think the same rules of thumb come into play for hydrocarbons that come in for chlorinateds, and that is that if a lot of your material is in the permeable zone, then what you're going to get is a quick removal and then a slow, you're going to get it out quickly. If it's had time to age, if it's young, you basically are going to get high concentrations and then it's going to go down. If it's had time to age, then it's going to have diffused into finer grain materials, and then you would use a gamma that's greater than 1, maybe 1.5. Some of them are like that. So the same rules of thumb play, and the one overlay that you have with the petroleum hydrocarbons is Raoult's law, which we'll talk about in a minute, but that basically tends to, for soluble components, move you more toward 1 because Raoult's law behaves a little bit more like that, as Chuck was saying.
And so just to wrap up, there is RenFuel isn't the new model on the block. It came out in 2012. There aren't any real detailed case studies, I don't think, that have been applied to where people have thought about gammas and things of this nature. So I think there's a lot of good research, a lot of good science that needs to be done to flame some of these ideas up. But still a powerful tool, a lot of different capability to talk about different situations, and I think there's a great future in the model to help us think about some of our site problems and how to work with them. So that's a little bit about the source, going to the plume remediation model. It's the same deal with RemChlor in terms of this space-time, going home. So you fuel guys can say the same thing to your family that you're also dealing with in space-time concepts. Here on the x-axis is the distance from the source in meters, and here it's broken up from a 0 to 60 meters to 60 to 100 and 100 meters on. The y-axis is the time axis, where 1995 was when this release occurred. There was natural attenuation that occurred until 2005 when the site managers went in there and said, we're going to do chemical oxidation in this short distance just on gradient of the source, do air sparging in this second zone, 60 to 100 meters, and the natural attenuation from there on out. And so your challenge is for all the constituents you pick, and in RenFuel you can pick a lot of parameters, you have to put these decay coefficients in there for each one if you're using a first-order decay model. So a lot of capability in here. It's also got some more bells and whistles in terms of these different constituents you can apply, in terms of the actual kinetic model that you use. So a lot of different things going on here. But space-time, these 9 zones, it's still the same concept in here. So the, you also have the coupled parent-daughter reactions in the plume, but instead of the chlorinated, it's going from PCE to TCE to cis-DCE to vinyl chloride to ethene. It's really this one MTB into TBA. So pulling these down, you have these same reaction expressions where MTB is going away on the top one. For the TBA, it is going away, but it's also being produced as the MTB decay. So you would put in decay rates for all these different things in terms of the parents and the daughters. And then you can increase these in certain space-time zones to simulate enhanced plume remediation, going in there and say, adding oxygen, making more aerobic, or some other things like that. Also, it says here that instead of just this first-order decay coefficient, which are in these rate equations here, you can model a zero-order decay, which is just a certain number of grams per day are going to be degraded, or Monod kinetics, where you sort of have a more sophisticated, more detailed curve that's based on a half-saturation constant that you would put in. What's the concentration where you're at half of your maximum rate? So let's look at how the thing is set up. Here's the actual input. We see REM fuel in here instead of the plume. I think REM chlor's got actually a picture of a plume on here. This has just got the big billboard. You're in the REM fuel world. Has the same look and feel in terms of the interface. You're going to put in your source parameters, your dimensions, things of this nature on the left. And then you've got their decay coefficients in the middle where you're going to put those into these different space-time zones. And then on the right-hand side over here, you can select these different components. And there's a lot of them in here that you can add. You've got the BTEX components. You've got these MTBE. You've got the DIPE. You've got 1,2-dichloroethane. I think there's about 20 different constituents you can put in here and model. So if you like graphs with 20 different lines on them all going different ways, this will work great for you. Down below this, you can see these different reaction rate expressions, zero order, first order, Monod predictions. For some of the compounds, you don't have Monod reaction kinetic expressions or data, so it doesn't give you that option, but for many of them, you do. Here's this yield from the parent, from the daughter, so you'd put in how much of that on a mass basis is going to the daughter product, and then you've got information on the source right in here. Now, in addition, there's some other things in here that help you set up a run and model it that's a little different than REM chlor. And here is you can pick your fuel. And so with there are these built-in calculators. The one on the top left there is something to help you come up with an initial concentration calculation. So you're going to pull down and you get your pick of 20 different hydrocarbon mixes. You can pick crude oil. You can pick, in this case, up here, gasoline, unleaded with high MTBE. You can do conventional, regular-grade gasoline, but for only elevations above 3,000 feet if you're in Denver and you need to do this. So about 20 different fuels in here you can pick, and it's going to give you the default value for a mole fraction for constituents, and then you can add a dilution factor and in the end come up with this initial concentration, in this case 0.00644 grams per liter. On the right-hand side, is there a comment?
Yeah, check this, Brian. I was just going to note that these are the kind of tools that you have in some of the other practical models and practical tools that are out there, but these happen to be built into REM fuel. But there are other models that are distributed through EPA and other organizations that do these kinds of things. But one of the things that's really handy is to have some of these fuels pre-populated that can fit in there. And the other note I was going to make, some of these screenshots are relatively small, so for those of you who are interested, this may be a time you could go to full screen because there's going to be a lot of screenshots and running models coming up where it would be helpful to be full screen.
Yeah, Brian, that's great. In terms of the origins of this, it's in REM fuel, and yeah, we're going to start going into the models, so go full screen if you can. Right-hand side, that's a mass calculation, where if you have a certain volume of, say, gallon release, you want to estimate that. You got this mole fraction, it'll tell you the mass of the constituents that's down there. Then a retardation factor, you can calculate this based on fractional organic carbon, bulk density, and then it's going to take this lookup table and tell you a retardation factor for one of the for the constituents that you choose. It also lets you pick the number of significant digits in here, which I think is pretty interesting, pretty useful. Of course, I always like to do 15 significant figures just to make sure I get that super, super accurate in here. Okay, just joking about that. Okay, so let's go on. These LNAPL components can be chosen from this library. So here are the different constituents that you can see in here, pulling down, and you can put them all up in here at one time. This EDB component only has the kinetics, default kinetics for a zero-order reaction and first-order reaction. So here's this decay rate that you would use for the first-order decay rate. That's in units of per year. And then from here, then you can simulate this and run it. So a lot of these useful calculators that, as Brian said, were in other parts of some of the EPA web pages, very useful ones that are actually hardwired, built in by the interface team on RemFuel, and right at your fingertips, and so you can run this. So that's sort of a overview of RemFuel, and got a lot of work to do coming up in about the next hour, looking at how to apply this to a site. But let's do the fun thing first, is something that I'm sure all of us would like to do at some point in our lives. Let's spill 10,000 gallons of gasoline into the ground. We assume this was in 1997. This was an unleaded regular gasoline with a high MTB concentration. We got a groundwater seepage velocity, 94 feet per year, moderate degradation in the plume. And Ron, you're going to tell us how we're going to simulate this type of release and what RemFuel says is going to happen.
That's right. We're going to switch here. And so this is a hypothetical case, 10,000 gallons, as Chuck said, and I'm going to run through how you would do a simulation of this with RemFuel. So I'm going to move out of the PowerPoint, and I'm going to open up RemFuel on my computer and go to full screen and try to size it so you can see it. I know that some of the numbers are kind of small here. And we're going to look at a couple of cases. We're going to look at a natural attenuation case, so what would happen over time if we just let the source and the plume attenuate. And then we'll look at a combined source and plume remediation scheme to see how that changes it. So I'm going to switch now out of PowerPoint. And I changed my background. There was a complaint last week about the Clemson orange. One person said it was irritating, so I switched to this green flower, so maybe that's better.
So, Ron, what did they want you to put on there?
They suggested Mizzou black and gold, but maybe I'll do that next week.
One other thing to point out, I'm going to go ahead and interrupt. This is a reminder. Now is the time for our users to try that full screen button. In case you're having problems viewing his RemFuel screen, again, on your end in Adobe Connect, there's a full screen button in the top of the share window. You can click that on and off and kind of toggle between the full screen view and then the regular view. Thanks.
Okay, so when you open RemFuel, again, you have to have administrator privileges. You have to right-click, run as administrator, the same as with RemCore. And when you open it, it has the same look and feel, the same kind of file structure, the same sort of file handling. The help is the same. The user's manual is right there as a PDF, searchable help, and so forth. Now, there are two files that we're going to use for this exercise. I already have them loaded on mine. One's called Gasoline No Remediation. One's called Gasoline Source and Plume Remediation. So you should be able to download those from the site right now if you haven't already. Now, so I already have opened these, so I could just click on them, and it would take me to the path. Here's the full path. Or I can kind of do it the slow way, open project, and I'll have to hunt around on my computer and find it this way. But this is probably the most common way to do it. So it takes a little bit of time if it's buried deep in the program like this.
Ron, this is Brian. It is the most common way to do it the first time, but, of course, once you've opened it, then you just click it on the side.
That's
there.
True, because then the program can remember the path. So it'll keep it stored where you had it, but it remembers where it is. So unlike the RemClore file that ended in .rch, the RemFuel ones, they have the same general structure, the end in .rfl. So it doesn't really mean anything except that's what it recognizes. So I'll pick gasoline, no remediation, and open that one, and it brings me into the input screen. So the input screen is parts of it are exactly the same as REM core, other parts are different. If we start at the top, we start off with a gamma, but you'll notice there's no source mass there, and that's a key difference. The reason it's not there is that we now have as many as 20 different components, and we need the source mass of each of those. So it's shifted over to this side, where it says select compound and compound-specific parameters. The source mass now becomes a compound-specific parameter, like how much benzene is there, how much MTB is there, and the source concentration as well. So those two parameters are moved from the general source area over here over to the compound area. These other parameters are similar. We have the width and height of the source, but we also have the length, and that has to do with the way source degradation is treated. In REM fuel, it's an aqueous phase degradation, and because of that, we need to know the volume of water in there to be able to calculate that reaction. In REM core, it's calculated based on the total mass of the contaminant. And again, that's for the decay that happens in the source zone besides flushing and besides other kinds of remediation. These two parameters are the same, the Darcy velocity, the porosity. The source remediation is treated the same as in REM core, so we remove some fraction over some time period. These transport parameters are the same, so we have that same standard deviation of the velocity, the number of stream tubes, the dispersion coefficients. Now, where things are a lot different are when you start to add the components. So on this one, I've already set it up with benzene, toluene, ethylbenzene, xylene, and MTBE. If I wanted to add another component, I would just click this Add Component button, and that would bring me to this utility where I can select another one. So I could pick any other one here. I could add M-xylene, for example, if I wanted to. And if I wanted to add M-xylene, I could go to the calculator to calculate how much would be in there. And that's where it depends on what kind of NAPL you have. And here's the list of the different kinds of NAPLs that are built into this model. So you can put numbers besides that, but if you wanted to populate the field with these defaults, then you'd pick one of these. So this one we're doing is unleaded with high MTBE, and so we know from the database that that has a certain mass fraction, about 5% of this component. We know the molecular weight of it. We can convert that into a mole fraction. We know the pure solubility. For Raoult's law, we'd multiply those together and get the effective solubility, and then we could modify that by saying, well, it's diluted by a factor of 5. If that was the case, we'd put 0.5 in there. So this number down here, then, would be the effective concentration you'd expect to see in groundwater resulting from that much M-xylene being in the gasoline. And again, this is grams per liter, so this would be 4,420. So that's how you would add components. I'll do one in a little while where I walk through that in maybe a little more detail.
Ron, before you go on, can you talk about like how you'd add a contaminant that's not on your list, and also is there a limit to the number of constituents you can add?
Well, you can add one, and a way to do that would be just to I guess pick one of these, but then you can put whatever you want in here. So we'll call this Schala's contaminant. And you could pick Minode kinetics, and you could put different numbers in here for these things. And you could put whatever concentration you want in here. That's too high, probably, but maybe I didn't do that right.
Ron, I think maybe you copy from Kern and then do what you just did and say, okay, and I think it works.
I don't know. I hit the wrong button before because it worked just
okay.
then.
Yeah,
so hopefully that wasn't too confusing. But so I just added one, a new component called test. And if I can go in and change these things, you can get to these calculators a couple different ways. So when you first add a component, the calculators are available. After you've added the component, you can get to them down here. So we have the concentration one, and again, that's based on Raoult's law. So you have to know the composition of the gasoline, and you have to know the solubility. Now, for the list of chemicals that are in there, the solubility is built in. And for the list of gasolines and fuel mixtures, the mole fraction is built in. But if you have something besides that, you can type whatever numbers you think are appropriate in for these things. So you can override all these defaults. And this might be a good time to just mention where those numbers come from. So let me just move out of here and go to the manual. They're from some tables in the manual that were compiled in a couple of different studies. They're down around page 23. So this first table, these are the components that are built in. And again, you can add other ones if you want, but these are probably the most common ones. So these are the built-in solubilities in grams per liter, the built-in molecular weights, the organic carbon partition coefficient that's used for adsorption, suggested first-order rate coefficients per year, suggested zero-order rates if you choose to use the zero-order decay model, the Monod kinetic parameters for certain compounds where that reaction is believed to be applicable. And then the second chart pertains only to the first order rates, and it gives a range and it gives a reference. Chuck, do you know this person, Rafai?
Yes, I do. Hanadi Rafai, University of Houston, a full professor there, did a lot of the key compilations of different degradation study. And also my spousal unit.
I thought there was a... Okay. So that's where those numbers come from. And then on this next page, these are the different fuel mixtures that are built in. And again, you can override these. But the one that we're looking at now is this unleaded gasoline with high MTB. And this comes from some extensive surveys that were done by the EPA, Jim Weavers and others at the EPA. So looking at this gasoline with unleaded with high MTB, it's got 0.6% benzene, 5.9% toluene, 1% ethyl benzene, and so forth. 12% MTBE, and you can go across. The density's 0.72 kilograms per liter. And so there's a number of fuels built in here, and then you could modify them. Jet fuel, diesel, kerosene, fuel oils, crude oil. About 10 different gasolines. So I just wanted to point out that the numbers that are in these calculators, they're listed here with references in the manual. So I'm going to delete that component test, and I'm going to delete the p-xylene because we weren't using those. But you can add and delete these as much as you want. So again, going through these calculators, like for MTBE, the way I got that concentration, for that particular gasoline, it's 12% MTB, so very high MTBE. We convert that mass fraction into a mole fraction using this ratio of molecular weights. We know the pure solubility is 48 grams per liter, so we multiply that by the mole fraction. And then here we can do this dilution factor, just saying that it's not going to come out at the solubility. It's probably going to be mixed with some water. If we pick 0.5, that would give us 3.8 grams per liter, which is a very, very high concentration. So that's the number that's located over here. Now, be careful if you go in and click this button. Be careful because this number always resets to 1. So if you're going to recalculate it, remember to change that. Now, on the mass, that's kind of a similar thing. You have to tell it how much, what's the volume of NAPL, and you can do this in units of gallons or liters. In the United States, we always use gallons, even though the rest of REM fuel is metric. So this was 10,000 gallons. This mass fraction came from this database, as did this density. So that's 3,270 kilograms. Now, again, be careful. If you just go back in there, see that reset to zero. So if you click that button and go in, you need to be very deliberate about that. The retardation factor, this KOC, organic carbon particulate coefficient, is built into the model. The fraction of organic carbon, this would be the site-specific number that you would enter. So this is 0.2%, but it would be different at different sites. Dry bulk density, 1.6. And then this is the calculation to get the retardation factor. So that's more or less how you build this up. Now the big difference, the other big difference, is the shape or the way you get in the data for the plume remediation. Before, we had one of these matrices, and then we toggled through components. Now we have two for each component, just because that seems like a more convenient way to do it. And the logic behind that is that in this program, we're going to have a maximum of one daughter compound. So we felt like we could fit it all on one page. But the meaning of these two matrices can change. So this is for first-order reaction. You have the parent compound, which is here benzene, and these are first-order rates. And then you have what's called benzene daughter. Well, we don't normally worry about the benzene daughter, but if we were looking at MTBE, then we do care about the MTBE daughter because it's TBA, terpenyl alcohol. So here we have rates for MTBE and then first-order rates for terpenyl alcohol, and we have a yield over here of the terpenyl alcohol from the MTBE, and that's the ratio of molecular weights. Now, if we were to pick a different kind of reaction, like zero-order reaction, you notice it just changed. We only have one set of parameters for the zero-order reaction, and that's just a rate, milligrams per liter per day. If we pick Monod kinetics, we get the two windows, but they have different meanings. The top one now is a maximum utilization rate in units of milligrams per liter per day, and the bottom one is the half utilization rate in units of milligrams per liter. So you have to be a little careful about that. The most common one that we use, I would say, is the first-order reaction. I guess one other thing I should mention, the source decay. So this would be the rate per year at which that component, in this case benzene, is decaying in the source zone by aqueous decay. And here it was set equal to the same rate as in the plume. So you can set that independently for all the chemicals. These simulation parameters work the same way as before, so I don't think I have to discuss those. So I'm going to run this one. It has a lot of stream tubes, probably more than we need, so it's going to take a long time to run. I'm going to just do it. It'll take about 20 seconds here, at least on my computer, and so it'll probably take about that long on yours. What you'll find is that the runtime varies directly with the number of stream tubes. So if you don't need 1,000 stream tubes, there's not really any reason to. You're going to pay a penalty in terms of having to wait if you run it with 1,000. So you can see, it ran then. So you saw how long that took. Let me just repeat this one because I know it works with 100. So that took about 20 or 30 seconds. Let's try with 100. So a few seconds. See how much faster that was? So just keep that in mind. If it seems like it's slow, see if you can get by with fewer stream tubes within reason. It's going to tend to be slower if you also have a lot of components because it's just having to do more calculations. So after it runs, we look at the output the same way. We go to this output versus distance. We have the same kind of graphics. Probably if we're looking at concentration, we would change this axis in some cases. And maybe if we're looking at these compounds, we probably don't care much down below 1, and maybe we'll look at just a regular number on the y-axis. And down in this corner, we can toggle which components we're going to look at. So you'll notice we have all the ones we put in there, and then each one is assumed to have a daughter. Most of them just say, like, toluene daughter, ethylbenzene daughter, but the MTB, the program knows that that goes to TBA. So actually, we do want to look at TBA, but let's not worry about the xylene and ethylbenzene and toluene because they're not usually the biggest concern. So now we have a graph with benzene, and I'm just going to make that red so we can see it. So I just right-clicked on that, and I'll just change the color of it. We have the MTB up here, and we have the TBA, which is being produced from the decay of the MTB. So the first thing you'll notice here is that immediately after this spill, we have a huge amount of MTB in the water, a few million parts per billion, in fact. And that's because of the large amount of MTB in this case and the very high solubility of the MTB. And then we have hundreds of thousands of parts per billion of TBA in this plume near the source here, because of the decay. And then our benzene is maxing out at about, looks like, 7,000. So, again, we can watch this over time. If we go up and click the time area here, you can use the arrow key. That's what I'm doing on my computer. So I'm just pushing the arrow key and watching these plumes grow. So you see in this case, the MTB plume and the TBA plume are way out ahead of the benzene plume. That's because they have a low retardation factor, and also because they had such a high concentration. And so over time, as we get out 15 years in this scenario, that would be the current date. So now we're starting to see the MTBE dropping very quickly. So it's actually starting to wash out of the source and go away. It's washing into the plume, but it's also decaying in the plume. So if I go back up, you can see the MTBE was leading the way. It was leading the plume and out almost twice as far as the benzene. But then with increasing time, it's shrinking. And if I go into the future, so 2012 would be 15 years in this case. If I go to 2017, we see that actually the benzene plume is dominant and the MTBE is shrinking. And if we go on out 30 years after the spill, so this would be the year 2027, we're left in this case with pretty much just a benzene plume. So these different components can have much different behavior, and it's a kind of a complicated function of how they wash out of that source zone based on their solubility and their initial mole fraction, and then how they react in the plume in terms of their degradation rates and their retardation factors. And each of these can have different retardation factors. So I want to just show you another kind of quick example. Suppose that instead of this gasoline with MTBE, we had an old leaded gasoline. So I want to just show you a case of adding components. So let's go here and delete the MTBE and assume that this gasoline had the same BTEX composition, but it was a leaded gasoline, and it had the leaded gasoline scavengers. These are lead scavengers, ethylene dibromide and 1,2-DCA. So I want to add the EDB, and I need to have an initial source concentration. Well, I know from some work that I did that the mass fraction of EDB in gasoline back in the 60s was around 0.0004. That's 3/10 of a gram per liter. Sorry, let me not do it that way. Let me do the calculator. So 0.0004. So that's going to calculate how much EDB should be in the groundwater. If I use that same dilution factor of 0.5, that's giving me about 480 parts per billion. And then I need to calculate the mass. And let's say we had 10,000 gallons and that same mass fraction, three zeros and a four, so about 10 kilograms. So we just added the EDB, and it has those parameters. The only thing I have to do now is calculate the retardation factor. And so I just added the EDB, and I'll just go ahead and add the DCA the same way. And again, use the calculator. And put in the dilution. The DCA has a higher concentration because it has a higher solubility. So here it's about 1,800 parts per billion. And then again, the 10,000 gallons. And the same mass fraction. And I have to calculate the retardation factor. So now I just changed it from a modern gasoline, or relatively modern gasoline MTB, to an older one that has the gasoline lead scavengers in EDB and DCA. And so I could do a simulation of this one. And it should run pretty quickly. And I can look at it the same way. Now I'm going to keep this same scale because the EDB actually has a drinking water standard of 50 parts per trillion. So 0.05 ppb. And let's just look at the benzene, which I think I'll make red again by right-clicking on it and picking this red color here. And the DCA, I'll just make it black so you can see it better. So we have the benzene, the 1,2 DCA, and the EDB. And if we go out in time, you see those lead scavengers leading the plume. Now, it depends what concentration we look at, but the EDB has a drinking water standard of 50 parts per trillion, so that's down here. So we'd have an EDB plume at this time of 9 or 10 years after the release. It's 300 meters long. The benzene has a drinking water standard of about 5, so actually by the MCL it would be a shorter plume. But the main point I want to make is that you can fairly quickly change these mixtures. And on this one, what you would see is that after you get out to late times, eventually those lead scavengers wash out of the plume, although they don't go away, and you wind up having this kind of mingled plume that has EDB, DCA, and benzene in it. So let me go back to the PowerPoint presentation for a minute. So we kind of did this case with the MTBE, and we looked at the plume, and it was at early time kind of dominated by the MTBE. At later time, that part of it was going away. And so the MTBE for that case that I showed earlier, those plumes are shrinking while the benzene plume is stable. So that's a characteristic of these gasoline sites, is that the different components may be doing different things. One may be growing while another one's shrinking, so you really have to be looking at them all at the same time. But let's go to that case now and look at remediation. So let's do two things. Let's say that this year in 2012, we'll take out 90% of that NAPL. And we're going to assume that we get a one-to-one response, a gamma of one. And then let's also evaluate what would happen if we did some kind of plume remediation between 20 and 100 meters down gradient and do it for 5 years. And we're going to express that as an increase in the decay rate. So you'll have to use a lot of judgment about the technology and what you think is reasonable for increasing the decay rate. But what I often do for these is go to the high rate of decay that I see in the literature. So I'm going to assume that the plume remediation increases the benzene decay rate by a factor of 4, but that it doesn't affect the MTB or the TBA. So I'm going to go back to the model now. Oops. think I just closed the model altogether. Let me open it again. So I'm having to do the whole right-click run as administrator. So, okay. So back at RemClore, and now I want to open this file, gasoline source and plume remediation. And in the interest of time, I'm just going to click it here because that takes me directly to that path. Well, this file is very, very similar to the last one. And in fact, the only things that are changed here are that I said I'm going to remove 90% of the source between years 15 and year 15 and a half. So if this was in 1997, that would be this year, 2012. And then for the benzene component, between year 15 and year 20, and between 20 and 100 meters, I'm increasing the rate by factor 4. So it's going from a background rate of 1.1 per year to a rate of 4.4 per year. So that's how I'm simulating that plume remediation in that window. Now, on the MTBE, I didn't change that, so I'm assuming that it does not affect the MTBE, that it only affects the benzene. And let's see, I'm going to change the number of stream tubes here and just make it 100 so it runs faster. So that one's done, and we can look at the output versus distance. And again, I'm going to right-click here and not look at so many digits, so we'll just go down to 1 part per billion. And let's just look at the benzene. Let's unclick a few of these, but then add the tert-butyl alcohol. So we have the benzene, the MTB, and the tert-butyl alcohol. And this should look the same as the other one for the first 15 years. So I'm toggling down with the arrow key. You see the plume developing. The MTB is dropping. By 15 years, we're pretty much dominated by benzene. And now all of a sudden we have the effects of remediation. So back up and go back down. Two things are happening here. Near zero, everything's dropping by a factor of 10 pretty much, and that's because we took out 90% of the source. Out beyond 20 meters, then we get this big drop in this section between 20 and I think it was 80 meters. We get this drop in the benzene. So you see that lowering, but you don't see that in MTB because we weren't changing that rate. And as we follow that, we see it progress through. So this is year 20. This is the last year that we're maintaining the plume remediation. So we've really shortened that benzene plume a lot, but now look what happens after we stop that. That benzene plume starts to grow again, and that's because we discontinued the plume remediation. So it starts to reestablish itself, although at a much lower level because we've reduced the source. And then over time, that doesn't change much. So that's kind of the walkthrough here. I guess the only thing I didn't talk about is the mass discharge. That works the same way as in RemClore. So if you click that mass discharge button, you get into a graph of how much mass of which component is crossing that plane perpendicular to the groundwater flow direction. So let me go back here to the PowerPoint, and these are the points that I was making. These colors are different, but the effect of the source remediation is seen on all three components. The plume remediation only affects the benzene. And after a while, we have a short benzene plume, but it reestablishes itself some. The MTB is gone by this time, by the year 2024 in this simulation. So I think now we're due for a break before we shift gears. So I think we probably have some questions.
And Ron, this is Brian. Let me just kick in here. There, you know, there's all kinds of flexibility for the analyst to build things in. So, for example, if you have a deeply anoxic source zone, those degradation rates might be a little lower than the ambient in the plume, and you can account for that in the model. And then by getting oxygen in there, you can raise them up to background or higher levels. So there's all kinds of options that are available that you would use site-specific knowledge to use.
Yeah, you actually have four spatial zones for the aqueous degradation, one in the source and three in the plume.
Right.
Although the one in the source is not time dependent.
Right.
The way the ones in the plume are.
Yep. Okay. We do have some questions that have been lined up in the queue. I'm going to go ahead and take a break, though, and see if anybody on the phone lines has a question before I start with those electronic ones. If you haven't yet submitted them in the Q&A pod, please feel free to take advantage and type up your questions or comments in that online window that appears in the lower right corner of your screen. For those of you that were having problems viewing the RemCore and RemSchule demos, again, I do appreciate the comments. Unfortunately, maximizing the software will not help the font size. We tested that earlier. So the full screen button on your end is the best option. There's also a zoom in button about two icons to the right of the full screen button that'll let you kind of focus in at a much higher level. But unfortunately, your image may shift around. So I apologize that that's a little bit unsettling or not the best way to view the content. We do appreciate the comments that came in. So for those telephone questions, if you're on the phone lines, please feel free to go off of mute by hitting #6. And feel free to either identify yourself and organization before asking a question. Okay, well, I'm going to go ahead and start with some of the electronic questions that have come in on the line. And this first question that I'm going to take actually asks, it comes in from Marie-Claude, who asks, how does RemFuel compare to the LNAPL distribution and recovery model, LDRM, for or from API, the American Petroleum Institute?
So the question is, this is Chuck, how does it differ from LDRM?
How does it compare?
So, yeah. How does it compare or the differences? LDRM is really a multi-phase model that's really talking about how the actual free product, how the actual LNAP will behave in the subsurface. What RemFuel does is it assumes that LNAP body is in this box, and you're going to describe this box with these seven parameters, and then it's going to tell you what's going to happen in the future and how the plume will respond to any source remediation or plume remediation.
Okay, great. Our next question is going to come in from Steve, who liked your joke about significant figures, but they say that it does beg the question, how many significant figures do we have in these calculations, one or maybe two?
So the question is, what's a reasonable number of significant figures? And I think realistically you're talking about one or two in terms of the your confidence in the results. You know, typically you would add one more on top of that just so that the model gives you kind of a smooth output. So I think that's why three is the default. Is that a fair answer, Ron?
Yeah. Mathematically, internally the program uses double precision, which is 14, but that's just for the mathematics. You know, for the engineering side, it's the precision to which you feel like you know these numbers, which is probably one digit at most.
So the model's not even using as many as Chuck uses at 15.
Model's using 14, standard double precision. Yeah.
Uh-oh. And this is Chuck, and perhaps maybe Ron and Brian, we can just have a quick discussion about the accuracy or the what these simulation predictions mean. And I think it's important to realize that if it says that this plume is going to extend out to 980 feet, that it's not, you're not down to this nearest foot level, that it's not going to be 981 or 982. Is it going to be 900 or 1,000? You're getting closer there, but there is quite a bit of uncertainty in all the parameters that are going in here. And so a lot of users of BioScreen and BioCorp talked about how in some ways the usefulness of the model is that it's a learning tool, and that you set up these simulations, you perhaps get a glide path how you think the site's going to work. Over time, you get more data. And then if you need to, if you're deviating from that glide path, and you say, what's different? And you can change your conceptual model. So I think it's important not to say this is this cast in stone, it's this plume, it's going to get to be 980 feet long, and then it's going to recede. We just don't have the technology or the data or the ability to characterize the subsurface to that extent. Brian, Ron, you want to add to that?
You have to remember that there's a lot of very strong assumptions that go into a model like this, a homogeneous uniform velocity, you know, all these very strong assumptions. So it's never going to be exactly right. But what we hope is that it's more or less right. And like Chuck says, it's kind of an inexpensive way to educate yourself about what the system is sensitive to. Is it really sensitive to the decay rate in the plume, or is it really sensitive to certain source characteristics? That's more the intended use of it.
Okay, excellent. We've had another question that came in from Mark, who asks you to please define Monode or Monod.
This is Chuck. This is Monode kinetics is a particular way that you express what the rate of degradation is at various conditions. It's also called Michaelis-Menten kinetics out of some researchers from University of Toronto. So different ways you can express it, and it's in a lot of different fields. But you put in these two numbers, and first is the maximum utilization rate. And if these bacteria down there are perfectly happy, then there is just a maximum rate that they're going to be able to process and destroy these contaminants. The other thing you put in there is the half saturation concentration. And this is the concentration of the contaminant where that rate is half of the maximum rate. And so instead of a first order rate, it's just one where the degradation rate's dependent on the concentration you see. This one is these two different values, a maximum rate that sort of levels out at point, and then where's the halfway point.
And Chuck, it's fundamentally related or typically related to biological degradation, and those coefficients relate to how much of, for example, an enzyme is, how much enzyme is available maximally, and how much, you know, what happens to the rate as that enzyme is in essence covered up with the component of interest.
And then perhaps the last most important point is about half the people say Monod with the silent D, because I think he was French, and the other people, half people say Monod, and to me both are right.
And then the other half of the people say Michaelis-Menten.
That's right.
Mm. So that's three halves, sorry.
Okay, great. Our next question, actually, I'm going to take two more online. This one's coming in from Jonah, and they're asking, do the Y and Z tabs in the data output window allow you to select your transverse location or depth within the plume? And then the concentration time chart we're looking at always seems to give you values along a line parallel to the plume axis. Is it possible to get XYZ concentration data in a tabular format as output so you can visualize it in a 3D way?
So on the first part of that question, if you give it some Y values, then you can move over and look at different Y locations, but you are, I think, going out parallel to the X axis. So I don't believe that there's a way to easily do it transverse, but you can process the output fairly easily to make it go transverse, to look transversely.
Right. So the answer is the default location is down the plume center line in XYZ, but you can move down any line in X, Y, and Z space, but it's following along the direction of flow. And the only way to get the information asked about in the second part is to output the data file from one of those other formats, the comma separated variables or the TechPlot output formats, and then manipulate it in another program.
And I normally make contour plots using a program like TechPlot. That's pretty fast once you get the hang of it. You can just process that output and get a contour plot in a matter of seconds. So that's almost easier than making cross sections perpendicular to the plume. But
okay, we're going to try to take a couple more questions in the time that we do have allotted. This question has come in, and I'm not sure if you guys can answer it easily, but they've asked it a few times, so I'm going to go ahead and throw it to you. This question asks, if they have a source mass from an underground source, such as seepage from a closed impoundment or closed subsurface waste unit, do you have any suggestions on how to handle this problem?
This is Brian. I'm not sure I exactly understand the question, but basically it almost is a question of the release from an underground impoundment, possibly through the vadosone into the groundwater. And we talked about that briefly before, but basically you can draw your source box there, you have flexibility and authority over drawing your source box. So if you want, you can draw your source box around that in the VEOS zone and kind of think about gamma as being the release from that downward into the water table, and then use some standard assumptions as to the geometry of that in the water table. Or you can draw your source box down into the water table some distance and then make some assumptions there. So there's not a great answer to that, except for you have to try to come up with some reasonable way to draw your source box. It relates to the issue of time. I saw another question on here that had to do with, you know, what do you do about releases that occurred into the environment over extended time frames? And you do have to pick a date in REMCLOR and REMFUEL and put the material in at a date, which you tend to want to use an early date so the plume develops to its full length. For things that come out of the source slowly, that's a pretty reasonable assumption. For really soluble things, it becomes less good. And if it's a real problem, then you, in essence, have to go to another tool. You have to go to, like, a numerical model. So what do you think, Ron?
Well, with that original question, if I understand it right, if you had just a certain amount of leakage of contaminated water from the VEOS zone, you could have your cross-sectional area and flow rate just kind of reflect that, I guess. And that would give you that same kind of loading, but you'd have to be careful to get the groundwater velocities right. So that might be a little tricky.
Okay, our next question is going to come in from Rick, and you have your hand raised, but you've also typed something up, so I'm going to read it out loud on your behalf, Rick. But you questioned that the instructor said something about multiple degradation zones. Can these be used to model different terminal electron acceptor utilization, and can the Minot maximum rate be used to reflect terminal electron acceptor flux limits?
This is Chuck, and so I think there's a lot in that question. You could have these different zones represent different, so I think the first part is yes. They can represent different terminal electron acceptors, such as this is where, you know, oxygen is the terminal electron acceptor, or nitrate, or it's methanogenesis. And if you have information about different first-order decay rates that you would put in there, then that is one way you could simulate this. This is important for TBA, for example, which can go anaerobically, except if it's the methanogenesis is sort of this terminal reaction that's going on there. Regarding the Minot maximum rate, can that be used to reflect these terminal rates? The answer would that be yes. You can have the Minot rates in there be different for these different zones. If you have some process information, and you could put that in there for the different constituents so that in a different zone and for a different constituent, a different rate. And so I think the answer for both questions are yes.
Okay, I think in the interest of time, we're going to go ahead and continue on with the presentation, although we will take another break for questions before we close things out. If we didn't address your question yet, don't worry, it's still in the Q&A queue, so I will get to it or we'll get to it offline.
Okay, well, the last thing we're going to do today is go back to REMCLOR, but look at a more complicated situation with a tetrachloroethylene spill where we have daughter products and where it's a difficult case, as you'll see. And what I want to do is sort of set up the problem today and describe it, and then next week we'll run through how to simulate it and start looking at how to clean it up. So today we'll look at the M&A, what would happen to this kind of case if no action was taken. So it's another made-up example, but with realistic parameters, and it's one I made up several years ago when I first was working on this program to try to test the program out and try to see what it would take to clean up a problem. Actually, I made this one so difficult that it winds up being really hard to clean it up, as you'll see. So what makes it difficult is that there's a high groundwater velocity, a very powerful long-lived PCE source with a high discharge, but low natural attenuation. So we have low rates of decay of PCE to TCE to DCE to vinyl chloride, yet we have a very high concentration in the source zone, and we're going to define the plume by one part per billion. So we're going to be in this greater than 10,000 range for the ratio, and that really makes this one a challenge. So we're not going to run this one today. I'm just going to kind of describe it fairly quickly here. But you have it. It's built into the program, the RemCore program. It's tutorial number 6 is the MNA. Tutorial number 7 is that same problem with source remediation, and tutorial number 8 is the same problem with source and plume remediation. So if you want to take a look at that, you could kind of get ahead. So here's the scenario. It's a 1,000-liter release, which would be 1,620 kilograms of PCE, happened in 1979. We're going to assume it has this 1-to-1 ratio, gamma equals 1. The source concentration is very high, 100 milligrams per liter, which is about half the solubility of PCE. And the water flow through the source zone is fairly large, 300 cubic meters a year. I forget the velocity, but I think it's like 30 meters per year. The PCE is undergoing reductive dechlorination, PC, TC to DC to vinyl chloride. However, we're going to make the assumption that only half of the DCE is converted to vinyl chloride by reductive dechlorination, and that the other half is destroyed by some other mechanism. And we'll reflect that in the yield rate, as you'll see. So the groundwater velocity, as I said, is pretty high, about 30 meters a year. Retardation rates are low. These decay rates are from the low range of what you'll find in the literature. 0.4 per year for the PCE, 0.15 per year for the TCE, less than that for the DCE, and 0.2 per year for the vinyl chloride. So with this combination of parameters, the initial mass discharge into the plume is 30 kilograms per year, which is actually quite a lot. And so I won't talk about this too much now, but this is what the window would look like for setting up this problem in RemClor. The 1,620 kilograms and the 0.1s, 100 milligrams per liter, and the Darcy velocity divided by the porosity gives you a pore velocity of 30 meters per year, and the decay rates and so forth. We'll go through this one next time, so I'm not going to dwell on it too much now. One thing I'll talk a little bit about, though, is the cancer risk. Several of these are carcinogens, and these are the cancer risk slope factors. So this would be for PCE. This would be the oral cancer risk slope factor for PCE, risk per milligram per kilogram per day exposure. Well, this is component one, PCE, and this is would be the TCE, the DC, and the vinyl chloride. So if we run this simulation and I take the output file and put it into a contouring package, this is what it looks like in 2009. So this is 30 years after the release. So at this point, we still have 57% of the PCE remaining in the source zone. So we have a case where most of the mass is actually still in the source zone, but we have a growing plume. And this is the parent compound, PCE. This is the first daughter, TCE, the second daughter, DCE, and the third daughter, vinyl chloride. If we go another 30 years out, so this is way out into the future, the PCE plume is probably about stabilized now, but these daughter components are still growing, these plumes. So the TCE plume is growing, the DCE plume is growing, the vinyl chloride plume is growing. And even though this has been washing into the plume for 60 years, we still have a third of the DNAPL remaining in the source zone. So that sort of tells us that this problem is going to keep getting worse and keep growing. So if we go out to the 100 years, so out to 2079, I guess we'll all be retired by then probably, but we still have a PCE plume. It's starting to actually shrink a little bit because the source is being depleted. But the TC plume is still growing, and particularly the DC and vinyl chloride. And so this is telling us that this plume is growing, and if we don't do anything about it, it's going to keep growing for the foreseeable future, you know, if these rates don't change. And eventually it'll be 1,600 meters or about a mile in length with a large vinyl chloride footprint. So in terms of this a matrix of parameters. This is a case where it's kind of mixed. After the early time, we have a lot of mass in the plume, but still a lot of mass in the source. And that tends to be problematic, and it often means we need to treat both the source and the plume. This one is growing, and that's usually a bad thing. Well, I'd say it's almost always a bad thing because we need to stop it. And we have more than a factor of 10,000 between the source concentration and the plume concentration. So this one's going to be challenging for these reasons. Now, I talked a little bit about the risk. The REMCLOR program has a built-in cancer risk calculator. This is based on a pretty straightforward calculation that comes from the EPA Superfund guidelines. And the cancer risk is assumed to be a linear function of the exposure to the carcinogen multiplied by the cancer risk slope factor. So the exposure is calculated using what's called a chronic daily intake. That's the cumulative exposure to that carcinogen averaged over a lifetime. So this has units of milligrams of contaminant per kilogram of body weight per day exposed. And the way it's calculated in REMCLOR, we take the concentration at a hypothetical well. So you pick a spot and you pick a time, and you look at the concentration in that location, and you have to look over a time period. When was somebody exposed to the water? When were they drinking this water? So you integrate mathematically the concentration over that time period, and that helps give you an average concentration. But you multiply that integrated concentration times the average daily water intake, which is assumed to be 2 liters per day, and then you divide that by the average body mass, which is assumed to be 70 kilograms, and then you divide it by the average lifetime, which is assumed to be 70 years, and that gives you the average daily intake of that carcinogen over the exposure period. And the exposure period is limited to a maximum of 30 years. So once you know this chronic daily intake, that's multiplied by that cancer risk slope factor, and that's a number that you can find on the EPA, I think it's the IRIS database, and then states have their own guidance on those numbers. So you multiply those two together, and you get a dimensionless risk. It's a probability of getting cancer, not of dying from it, but of getting cancer. And if you have multiple carcinogens, you assume that the risks add together. This is described in the user's manual in a lot more detail in the REMCLOR user's manual.
So, Ron, that's just the standard, just straight down the line out of the Superfund guidance documents, right?
It is.
Yeah.
And I should mention, a similar thing is done for inhalation. So there, the assumption is you have the contaminated water coming into your house, and you're breathing some of those vapors in the shower, and then you're breathing some of them when you're in the bathroom, but not in the shower, and then you're breathing some of them in the rest of the house. So there's sort of three compartments, and there are assumed times that you spend in the shower and how many breaths you take in the shower and all that kind of thing. And again, that's using the standard methodology.
But that doesn't include vapor intrusion then?
It does not include vapor intrusion through the soil. It's just the contaminated water coming into your dishwasher and your sink and washing machine and shower and stuff.
Once again, standard Superfund.
Yes.
Yep.
So if we go back to that case where we had that plume developing for 100 years, if we look at a person in 2079 who was exposed over 30 years, this would be the cancer risk if they were at different locations from the source. So zero would mean they had a water well that was right at the source, and they were drinking that water from 2049 until 2079. And 1,000, they were 1,000 meters downgraded from that source, they're drinking that water of that same period. So it always goes backwards up to 30 years here in this calculation. So the risk is a fraction less than 1. If it was 1, it would mean 100% chance of getting risk. 10 to the minus 6 would be a 1 in a million chance of getting cancer. Not necessarily fatal, but getting a cancer because of the exposure to the carcinogen. So each of these chemicals has a different risk profile from the cancer standpoint. The PCE risk is high near the source and drops off quickly, and that's because the PCE plume never gets all that long. Then you have the TCE risk, and it's fairly high near the source because the concentration is high there, but then it drops off. And I should point out that these numbers are highly dependent on what you use for the cancer risk slope factors, and the recommended values for those numbers change sometimes. These ones are, I believe, numbers recommended by the state of California back in 2006 or so when I was putting this together. So just keep in mind that you need to find the numbers for the cancer slope factors. Here's the vinyl chloride risk, and it is low near the source because it's generated as the last of these decay, last of these daughter products. But when you get out in the plume, the risk is actually dominated by the vinyl chloride, and that's because it has a very high potency as a carcinogen. It has a higher slope factor than these other compounds. So if we look at the overall risk, which is adding these together, it's dominated by PCE near the source, but it's dominated by vinyl chloride in most of the plume. So one way to look at treating this plume, if you look at this risk, would be to say that, well, we really want to suppress the vinyl chloride. I mean, we want to take care of all these contaminants, but the vinyl chloride is driving the risk once we get beyond a few hundred meters. So this kind of graph is produced inside REMCOR, and maybe it's helpful to gain a different perspective. And to put this risk in perspective, 10 to the minus 6, 1 in a million, that would be kind of a typical level where the drinking water standards are set, to where the risk is believed to be around 10 to the minus 6, and sometimes a little bit higher. So certainly a risk of 10 to the minus 4 or more, we would think that's a case where something needs to be done for it.
And Ron, this is Brian. So basically what we have here is this is another option within REMCOR, and one of our goals for the class was to think about how you might set a variety of objectives for either interim or final status at a site. And what this means is that you have this tool to use risk as one of the ways to think about setting goals or kind of suppressing the impact of sites on the environment.
Yeah, we have concentration, we have discharge, and we have cancer risk.
And then just a little more supplemental information about other tools for risk assessment, and we talk about some of them here. We've got the CLEA, Contaminated Land Exposure Assessment Tool from the United Kingdom. We have BP Risk, this risk-integrated software for cleanups. And then one that I know very well, this is the Rebecca Toolkit for chemical releases. This is something that our shop sells and presents. This is based on the ASTM Rebecca processes. And these tools all look at a variety of pathways besides groundwater exposure. They can look at surface water exposure, air exposure from particulates or volatilization to outdoor air. They look at the indoor air pathway. So these tools can give you a more broad spectrum of different exposure pathways than just the volatilization or in the shower from the water or from the ingestion itself. And so with that, I think we move on to some more questions from the group. Is that right?
Yeah, I think so.
And let's see. We have Gene. Are you going to read off some, or would you like us to do this? I think we've lost Gene. Can we see some of the comments, and we'll just read some of them off?
Hey, guys. I'm so sorry. I apologize for that. There was a bit of a lapse on my end. I was stuck in that mute limbo, but I am back with you. And we'll go ahead and start to take some of those questions that have been submitted online. And I'll hopefully have my audio fixed in just one second. So I'm going to go ahead and start from some of the questions that have been submitted electronically. You guys can continue to type them up in that Q&A window. And we'll try to get to as many as we can in the time that we have left. And then in just a few minutes, I'll go ahead and turn to the phone lines if there's anybody there that has a question that would rather ask them out loud. So the first question that I'm going to take online actually comes from Lisa, who asks, what is the gamma value that was assumed in the previous EPA bioscreen model?
Oh, this is Chuck, and that's a real good question. I'll give you the real short answer, and it assumes a gamma of 1. And then sort of the longer answer is, when we were working with Bioscreen, this is some time ago, is I did have this vision that these sources were decaying exponentially, this concentration versus time, that as these sources, they do weather, these concentrations do drop. And then I actually did this integration, the first time I did integration since college, and I was very proud of myself. I think I showed it to everybody in the office. And sort of this derivation of how this works, and this would mean the concentration of the mass are in lockstep, and you have this gamma of 1. So in Bioscreen, gamma of 1, but that was all you could do. RemFuel and RemClor give you this additional dial where you can twist this and turn this depending on what you think that architecture of that source really is.
So, Chuck, what you were saying is you actually didn't have gamma back then, but you figured out this middle of the road was something that was reasonable to assume. And what gamma does is it gives you extra capability to describe an effect of source architecture or age or these other things that is available now in RemClor and RemFuel.
That's right.
Yeah,
our next question comes in line from Carl. And Carl asks, does RemFuel also have the capability to model the behavior of so-called biofuels, ethanol, methanol, and their interactions with DTEX and CBE?
Well, it can simulate the ethanol itself, but there aren't really coupled reactions in here. So, in other words, the benzene concentration is not going to be dependent on the ethanol concentration in these simulations directly. You could, if you knew where the ethanol was going to be, you could alter the benzene rate in that space and time location, but they're not fully coupled. But it could, so it assumes that they're acting independently, but you definitely could add the biofuels.
Okay, great. Our next question comes in from Bradley, who asks, can RemFuel estimate the reduction of the bulk products or aliphatics, sometimes referred to as TPH?
And this is Chuck. It really is not designed to do that. And I'm thinking of these longer-chained compounds like octane or things of this nature. It's really looking at the soluble components, and it's these 20 constituents that are in the pull-down menu, starting with BTEX, than the oxygenates. That's really focused on those as opposed to the longer chain stuff. I guess you could simulate, a dissolved TPH.
You'd have to give it some average solubility and so forth.
Mm-hmm.
You could do it, though. If you knew an average solubility, molecular weight, and fraction, you could do that.
But it's definitely simulating a dissolved constituents. And so represent...
Yeah.
Your TPH in some way and fill in those boxes in RemFuel, then you could do it.
Actually, it would work pretty well, although what you would see is the TPH would hang out for a really long time because of the low solubility.
Yeah, and the high mass.
Right.
Yeah.
Okay, our next question comes in from Zoe, and they ask, to accommodate the K rates for different geochemical conditions, do you plan to modify this model for N2SO4, FE, et cetera, for those types of concentrations?
This is Chuck. I'll take the first stab, and then Ron and Brian, you can pitch in here. Is the Bioscreen model was one where you entered in these electron acceptors, and one of the ways you could simulate biodegradation in Bioscreen was how much oxygen is flowing into that box, how much sulfate's in there, how much methane are you observing, and with that approach, which we call the instantaneous reaction method, then the biodegradation was a function of these electron acceptors. I think with RemFuel, Ron, you thought about it, but in the end said, nope, too complicated, we don't need it, and you just stuck with a first order decay, but then you added the Monod kinetics and the zero order to give you a little bit more flexibility on some of the kinetic expressions. Is that true?
Yeah, and part of it was I couldn't think of an easy way to add that instantaneous reaction with the same mathematical framework.
So another way of looking at another way of looking at it, though, is if that conceptualization, if the conceptual model of the electron acceptor being the dominant factor, and if you wanted to use the instantaneous reaction approach, this is a case where you don't marry yourself to any one brand of software. Then you go back and you use like the earlier bioscreen type of modeling approaches.
So bioscreen lives, right?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Thanks, gentlemen. Our next question comes in from Jimmy online, who asks, is there risk assessment in REM fuel also?
No, we didn't include it in that one.
Okay. Our next question comes in from M. Tony, who asks, should you use one model or the other if you have a mixed BTEX TCE plume?
That depends on if you have to go through the entire TCE degradation chain, you probably need to use REM chlor so you can have the two daughters and the parent. You would then reflect the effect of the BTEX as having an effect on TCE reaction rate.
But Ron, in some ways these two constituents would be out there and not know that either one is there, right? So then you could do two separate model runs with the same source characteristics and still get the right answer?
Well, except that perhaps the BTEX, you know, degradation might help improve the TCE degradation.
Yeah, serve as the electron
donor.
Mm-hmm. But then there's no linkage in the models or any way to express that. You would just have to do that indirectly by changing the first order decay coefficient.
Yeah.
Right, so you would just pick the near field decay coefficients for a co-disposal of hydrocarbons and assume that that would drive the oxygen down, and then you could put a higher coefficient for TCE in there and run it in REM chlor. Or you could do the same thing if you didn't care about following all of the daughters. You could do that in REM fuel by adding TCE as a component in there or DCE as a component in there.
That's right.
Okay, our next question comes in from Doug, who states that REM fuel provides a means to estimate source mass, but with respect to REM chlor, what ways other than trial and error can be used to estimate the source term mass? And they'd appreciate any input that the panel can provide.
Well, on REM fuel, you still had to tell it how many gallons, so it still kind of winds up being the same thing. Was it 1,000 gallons or 10,000? Sometimes we use that as a calibration parameter. I mean, you use logic too. You know, if a company had a certain process and they use a certain amount per year, then that kind of constrains it. But if there's 1,000 kilograms of mass in the plume, then you know the source was somewhat bigger than that. And if it's decaying at a certain rate, you can sort of go backwards and calculate, well, what's the minimum mass it would have taken to have made this plume given that, so many hundred kilograms have degraded. So you can kind of do a calibration and get an idea of what it might have been. But you still need to be careful that it makes sense.
And this is Chuck. Having even a rough mass estimate of what you think's down there now can be useful, and you can do that if you have soil data, milligram per kilogram data from the subsurface, and then you can use a tool like source decay to help estimate that mass. Or you can make some assumptions that there's a certain volume that has, for example, DNAPL in it or LNAPL, and you would assume a certain NAPL saturation, and you can get a mass there. And if you have the mass now, then you can say, well, in the past it had to be greater, and then that sort of gives you a starting point for thinking about mass at time zero.
You can also use source decay to calculate, if you have the NAPL, to calculate mass.
With the effect of solubility and stuff like that.
Okay. We have come up to our 3 p.m. scheduled end time, but I'm going to go ahead and continue on for at least a few more minutes, for approximately another 5 minutes or so, to try to get through a few additional questions. So I appreciate everyone if you can stay with us. Remember, if you're looking for information on getting a confirmation email, how to submit feedback, how to download the files, we'll cover all of that when we close out. So if you can hang tight for 5 more minutes, that would be much appreciated. So our next question comes in online from Lanzana, who asks, in reference to slide number 40, the max DCE and VC concentrations seem to separate from the source, where the high PCE and TCE are still present. Is this simply a modeling limitation, or does this actually have to be expected at a site?
This is what we expect at a site, because those are produced by the sequential parent-daughter reactions. So the further you get down the decay chain, the further away from the source you expect to see the peak of the daughter. I think this has been seen at a lot of sites.
Well, Ron, I would say some of this behavior has, but because of matrix diffusion effects, I think that there are a lot of these plumes that you see some higher concentrations down gradients, but I think it's pretty rare, especially in the chlorinated world, or in the MTB world, to see this whole thing completely detach. And I think matrix diffusion is a key part of that. This plume module doesn't represent that very well. And so I think maybe it's a little more optimistic about the chance for detachment.
Okay, thanks. Our next question comes in from Steve, who comments that mobilization of metals, in particular arsenic, is a concern at CVOC sites. So he'd like to know if REMCOR and its risk calculation handle that type of consideration.
It's only accounting for these compounds that we're modeling, and we're not modeling the arsenic release. So that's a little bit more sophisticated problem, I think, from a geochemistry standpoint. But we're only looking at the risk from the parent and daughter compounds that are directly generated.
Okay, great. Thanks. John would like to know if you can comment on how the ITRC LNAPL natural source zone depletion calculations compare to REM fuel. So this is in reference to the Interstate Technology Regulatory Council. Are you familiar with those calculations on LNAPL natural source zone depletion?
Yeah, so there's a great document that talks about how to estimate some of the natural source zone depletion, looking at things like carbon dioxide fluxes and things of that nature. I don't think there's been a direct comparison of these in terms of natural source zone depletion rates and what REM fuel would do. That's a very interesting question, and one that I think would be very useful to try to answer. The ITRC natural source zone depletion is more or less this framework for how you think about these attenuation rates and what's going on to the constituents in the subsurface. REM fuel is putting all this in a box, and then you would handle that with both the dissolution coming out of the box and then that first-order decay term that handles decay within the box.
And, Chuck, this is Brian. I think that this question is really good, and it fits into a category of several of the questions that we've been hearing, which is, you know, how much have these been used? Is there literature about how good they perform, how well they perform in different situations? I think what we've seen is that REMCOR has been around for a little while at this point, and it's been rolled out at several EPA regions. It's starting to see some use. It provides similar results to BioCOR, but REM fuel was developed later, and it's been through a fairly rigorous program where EPA sent it out for beta testing and peer review, and it did quite well in that scenario, but there's not a big track record yet. So I think that one answer to these questions is that these are all really pretty, really good ideas, and I think that the system is ripe for doing some of these comparisons. I think that these are all really good suggestions.
Okay, great. Thank you. We do have a comment from one of the participants, Paul, who comments that CLEA, C-L-E-A, does not consider contaminants in groundwater, and they also use a different tox basis for carcinogens, but that it's being updated to remove some of its over-conservatism. So I don't know if the panel has any comments on CLEA and some of their work in this area.
No, that sounds correct. So that that it is being updated. So I think that's a great comment.
Okay, great. So we had a question that came in from William, who would ask, what exactly are the modeling options for inorganic constituents?
It depends. If they are constituents that move with the groundwater and decay by first order decay, then you can use these programs for them. I've used remchlor before for radionuclides, you know, where it's undergoing radioactive decay and has adsorption. On the other hand, if it's a geochemistry problem that involves coupled reactions, you really need to use a geochemistry type program, transport program.
Right, and this is Brian. I think that there's a couple of parts of that. And first of all, if you use remchlor for radionuclides, you have to be a little careful. You have to adjust the first order decay because for organics, it's assumed that the degradation is only occurring in the water. So you have to do an adjustment by retardation factor because radionuclides clearly decay also on the sorbed phase. But the second part of the answer is that I think for inorganics, metals and radionuclides and other inorganics, you have a lot of really interesting and more complex and sophisticated nuanced geochemistry that goes on. There are several things that have happened. Chuck, with some other folks, worked on a scenarios document that describes in kind of rules of thumb and trends what happens for a large number of metals, radionuclides, and inorganics. And then there's a lot of sophisticated geochemical models that you can use if you want to go beyond that. So I think you can use these rules of thumb. There's also an EPA's guidance on natural attenuation for metals and radionuclides. There's general information and then compound by compound appendices, which are really interesting and useful to read through. So all of those are resources that you can use. Now, coupling the organics and the inorganic and radionuclide, pretty complex, has a lot of sophisticated geochemistry going on, and really you're almost stuck with thinking about things in a more sophisticated modeling perspective, and you have to just be a little bit more careful about that.
Okay, great. Thank you. I think we're going to go ahead and close out this portion of the Q&A. We do have a few others that were left in the queue, and I will work to get those to the presenters offline to try to address them later on. But there were a couple questions that I think we might be able to get some help with before we do close out. And the first one was a question coming in from Jerry, who asks if we could list the related URLs that were on the screen earlier. And I believe he's talking about earlier in the presentation, you guys had talked about some other models or some other resources. I don't know if it's possible to page up earlier in the slide deck.
So slide 46?
Might have been, yeah, the immediate predecessor to the question slide. And we will make sure that those URLs as well will be available on the related links page for the seminar homepage. And when I close everything out, you can also download a copy of the PowerPoint materials that our presenters have gone through and actually have all of those slides, all of the URLs and everything right in the PowerPoint deck that they've gone through today, and you'll find those materials on the seminar homepage. So they're not lost. They're definitely accessible to you afterwards. And this is just a clarifying question that came in from Josh, who wanted to know specifically which one of the presenters should they contact to get a copy of the PremChlor software.
Ron Falta. And my email should be on the first slide, I think.
Yeah, your email's there, and it'll also be on the seminar homepage, so I'll make sure that I can refer everybody to that. But, again, it's Dr. Ron Falta from Clemson University. You can email him directly to get a copy of those slides. So with that, again, we're going to stop with the live question period today, and I'll start with Brian Looney to see if you have any closing statements.
No, I guess over the next week, kind of scan over the examples that Ron just talked about, that more complicated problem, because we'll go through that and try different remediation ideas for both source and plume next week and play around with that. And we'll continue that in the final module and as a group try to come up with solutions and fix things for that site and look at the behavior of that plume as a function of different things. So thanks again for everybody's participation. It's been really interesting so far.
Okay, great. And Chuck, any comments from you?
Nope, I'm having a great time. Looking forward to talking to everybody next week.
Excellent. And Ron, any final statements?
Thanks, everybody, for participating, and we'll talk to you next week.
Okay, excellent. So with that, I'm going to go ahead and start the closeout procedures. Again, we went a little bit past our scheduled end time, but I appreciate everyone's patience for joining us today. We did have nearly 400 individuals who joined us from all over the country, as I mentioned, not only the United States, but also international participants in Canada. We've had people in Germany, people in China, so we welcome everyone who was able to join us from your relative locations. We do want to make sure that you understand that there are real people like myself involved with making the Cleanup Information Network run, and we're always looking for opportunities to network, to connect, and to share information. So in addition to running cluein.org, the Cleanup Information Network website, you'll also find us on social and professional networking sites like Facebook, LinkedIn, or Twitter. I'd encourage you to either follow us, like us, or join our group and actually participate in some of the dialogue and information exchange going on. On the final slide in today's presentation material, slide 49, you'll find two links. These links are also available in the upper right corner in the related URLs pod. For those of you that want a copy of the seminar slide, you'll find all of that as well as links to download the software, and we'll be sure to include some of the other links that were referenced in the presentation today on the related resources page. That very same URL is available in the related URLs page. You'll find that you can get to it on the seminar homepage. You can also get to it on the link that says homework and resources. That'll bring you right to the links page. The other link you'll see on 49 is a link to our short feedback form that's also up in that upper right corner in the related URLs pod. It does take just a minute to fill that form out. I do read each and every one of your comments, and I really do thank everybody for all of their thoughtful suggestions and comments on both the training as well as our delivery mechanism. We are looking to continue to improve this approach, so anything and any information you can provide to us is really helpful. If you had problems or looking for credits or confirmation of your participation today, we do not issue certificates, CEUs, or PDHs on Cluein. However, when you fill out the feedback form, make sure you check the box that's circled in red on this slide to have a confirmation email sent to you. If you've entered your email address correctly and checked that box, when you submit the feedback form, a confirmation message will appear on the screen. You can print that out, but the same message should also be emailed to you for your own records. If you keep that confirmation email, a copy of the slides, as well as your registration email, that will hopefully be enough to get credit for your participation. If you're having difficulty with that, you're welcome to contact me. This is Jean Ballant. I'm at ballant.jean@epa.gov. You'll find my contact info on the seminar homepage as well, and I'd be happy to work with you to try to verify your participation. If you shared the line with multiple individuals, each person can fill out their own feedback form and get their own confirmation record. And these resources will be available from this point forward on indefinitely from the seminar homepage. So if you're one of the lucky people who's replaying our broadcast, again, you can still find all of these links and resources on that homepage regardless of the date of the live delivery. Today's session was recorded, and you guys will automatically get an email once that archive is available for free replay. It usually takes us about a week. We're going to try to get it done sooner than that, and hopefully get it up in a few days. The next seminar in this series, again, this is part three. We're going to deliver part four same time next Wednesday. So on Wednesday, bear with me while I pull the calendar up in front of me.
Halloween.
Yes, Halloween. How can I forget? Wednesday, October 31st at 1 p.m. Eastern, we'll go ahead and kick off part four of the seminar series. So again, thank you to everyone. I want to thank all of our organizers who were able